This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Welcome to meeting number 108 of the House of Commons Standing Committee on Public Safety and National Security. Pursuant to the order of reference referred to the committee on Wednesday, December 13th, 2023, the committee resumes its study of Bill S-210, an act to restrict young persons' online access to sexually explicit materials.
Welcome back to the Law Bites podcast after a couple of weeks off. I've covered Bill S-210, which is marketed as a mandated age verification bill for pornography sites, but is about far more, on several occasions in the past, including earlier this year in a debate with Senator Julie Melville Deschênes, the bill's author and lead proponent. I first wrote about the arrival of Bill S-210 in the House of Commons back in December, when I dubbed it the most dangerous Canadian bill you've never heard of, and warned that Senate private members' bills rarely become law, but this bill is suddenly on the radar screen in a big way. Now, I must admit that it didn't really unfold in quite the way I expected. The Conservatives, having spent years as the lead voice for freedom of expression and warning about the risks of internet regulation, became the bill's most notable supporter in the House of Commons. While the government, save for a small number of Liberal MPs, opposed it, the bill received full backing from Conservative, NDP, and Bloc MPs to send it to the Standing Committee on Public Safety for further review. Now, the expectation was that this would lead to a robust review of Bill S-210, but it now seems almost certain that that won't happen. For several meetings, Conservative MPs used filibuster tactics to block all witness testimony on the bill. Once a deal was struck to get past the filibuster, the committee held one session on the bill with appearances from Senator Melville Deschênes, Privacy Commissioner of Canada Philippe Dufresne, who expressed concern about the privacy implications of the bill, and government officials from Canadian Heritage, led by Owen Ripley, who torched the bill on multiple grounds. Incredibly, that appears to be it. The bill will likely be reported back to the House unamended this coming week, and ultimately head for a straight up and down vote. It certainly remains possible that one of the opposition parties, the NDP or Bloc, may recognize the problems with the bill and choose to vote against it. Indeed, the government MPs emphasized that Bill C-63, the online harms bill, features duties that cover appropriate design for children that could be used to address some of the same issues. In any event, MPs only got a taste of the problems with Bill S-210. And since it seems likely that there will be no further committee hearings on the bill, I decided to turn this podcast episode into a what could have been episode with a mock hearing and myself as the witness. I'll start with an opening statement and then follow with clips of some of the actual questions that were posed by MPs in their only effort to ask witness questions about the bill, and then I'll provide some of my own responses. I'll start with my opening statement, which is borrowed at least in part from an appearance before a Senate committee that studied the bill back in 2022. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Geist. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where I hold the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law, and I'm a member of the Center for Law, Technology, and Society. I appear in a personal capacity, representing only my own views. I'd like to thank the committee for the invitation to appear on Bill S-210. I'd like to start by noting that I'm not averse to addressing the concerns identified in the bill. I have three children in their early 20s who are fortunate to grow up in a house where computers and internet access was ubiquitous. The concerns of this parent, like so many others, included concerns about exposure to content inappropriate for their age. I believed then and believe now that addressing the issue was my responsibility, and that included education, frank conversations, and an assessment of whether the use of internal blocking tools or filters were needed. Further, many years ago, when the government worked together with internet providers to establish Project Clean Feed Canada, an initiative to block access to the very worst child pornography images, I was a public supporter of the initiative, which struck me as an appropriate approach given that the content itself was unlawful and the blocking was limited to specific images, not entire websites. More recently, the government introduced Bill C-63, the Online Harms Act. While there are serious concerns about the inclusion of Criminal Code and Human Rights Act provisions, the elements of the bill involving the responsibility of internet platforms represents a far more reasonable approach, with the protection of children foremost in mind. But while blocking specific illegal imagery and some legislation may be supportable, this bill is not. Indeed, by bringing together website blocking, face recognition technologies, and stunning overbreath that would capture numerous mainstream services, the bill isn't just a slippery slope, it's an avalanche. There are many concerns, but in my limited time, let me focus on three. First, the reliance on website blocking. The danger of overblocking legitimate websites raises serious freedom of expression concerns, particularly since experience suggests that overblocking is a likely outcome of blocking systems. We've seen this in Canada dating back to 2005, when TELUS intended to block access to a single site supporting a union action and blocked hundreds of other sites in the process. The costs associated with site blocking could run into the millions of dollars, with significant investments in blocking technologies and services, employee time to implement blocking orders, and associated service issues. The result would be higher consumer costs and less affordable access in one of the highest cost countries for internet services in the world. Now, the bill itself expressly acknowledges that site blocking will involve blocking access to lawful content. In doing so, it represents an obvious candidate for a charter challenge and undermines Canada's commitment to net neutrality and an open internet. Second, I have similarly serious concerns about the reliance on age verification technologies, particularly the potential use of facial recognition technologies. We are only starting to come to grips with the risks associated with such technologies, which raise privacy concerns, fears of bias and error, security risks, and the potential for misuse. To actively legislate their use runs directly counter to the current movement that seeks to restrict the use of technologies until an appropriate and effective regulatory framework is developed. There may be some companies that do it better than others, but in the absence of a comprehensive regulatory framework, the last thing we should be doing is mandating its use. Indeed, these technologies will almost surely involve foreign operators, requiring Canadians to transfer their personal information to foreign companies. In some instances, that may mean uploading government IDs combined with facial recognition, which creates multiple privacy risks. In other instances, there are technologies such as age estimation, technology which scans faces to guess at a user's age. But that technology doesn't work in this use case, where the technology would be asked to distinguish not between, say, a 25-year-old and a 16-year-old, but rather between a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. Third, the overbreadth of this bill is simply stunning. While I realize that proponents may have certain sites in mind, we should recognize that the current definition covers some of the most popular and commonly used sites and services on the internet today. With no thresholds in the bill, unlike some comparable legislation in some other jurisdictions, websites covered by this bill would include search engines like Google, social media like Twitter, and chat sites like Reddit. Moreover, the bill's use of the criminal code definition for sexually explicit material means that streaming services such as Netflix, Crave, and CBC Gem could also be caught by the law. For a bill that purports to create an equivalency between offline and offline, using this definition in the context of Bill S-210 ironically has the effect of establishing age verification requirements for streamed content where none exist for the same content in a conventional broadcast world. The way that Canada seeks to limit access to such broadcasts, say episodes of Game of Thrones, is not via the criminal code or blanket liability on the provider, but rather through CRTC-backed content standards, which has led to a well-recognized rating system. Now, these are just some of the problems with the bill. Potentially vesting much of the bill's responsibility to the CRTC raises a series of additional enormous administrative problems as well. I recognize the good intentions with Bill S-210, but respectfully believe that the risks and harms far outweigh the benefits. I look forward to your questions. Now, that would be my opening statement. No doubt, questions would follow. And rather than just make up a series of questions, I thought it best to actually use some of the questions that were raised by MPs from all parties during the one set of questions that took place when Senator Merville Deschenes, Privacy Commissioner Dufresne, and the department officials appeared before the committee. And so I'll intersperse clips, which are questions from MPs being asked, not to me, obviously, but rather to some of those witnesses, but provide you with a sense of how I might have tried to answer some of those same questions. The questions from MPs come in order from first, Conservative MP Garnet Jenness on age verification methods. Secondly, Liberal MP Talib Nur Muhammad on online privacy. He's followed by NDP MP Alistair McGregor on site blocking. And there are two questions focusing on the same issue, the definition of sexually explicit materials, from Ekwinder Gahir, a Liberal MP, as well as once again Garnet Jenness. And then finally, NDP MP Alistair McGregor once again, this time focused on privacy safeguards.
Are there age verification methods that do not involve identity verification?
Well, thank you for that question. As I highlighted in my opening remarks, there are technologies that don't necessarily involve personally identifiable information in the sense that there will be an attempt to disaggregate the identity of the individual from their age, or at a minimum, not collect some of that information. But by and large, most of the technologies, which, as I mentioned, involve companies that are not Canadian-based, and so they involve requirements where this information would be uploaded or made available to foreign-based services, really fall into two broad categories. One category involves instances where official IDs that are reliable are made available to these services, and then the service endeavors to match the ID with the individual. Because simply providing an ID obviously doesn't work. And so what you need is both a credible ID that can be verified, as well as an attempt to identify the person to ensure that that ID actually belongs to them. Now, in those instances, those are in fact ID verification systems, right? So maybe providing a passport or providing a driver's license or some other piece of ID that has both identification of the individual, their age, as well as their photograph. And then there is the uploading or scanning of their face to try to ensure that they match with the underlying photo. Now, many of these services may take the position that they will discard this information upon collection, but that is quite clearly an instance where this information is being collected. And as the Privacy Commissioner noted during his appearance before this committee, the safeguards that exist in the bill are not mandatory. They merely have to be considered, and they leave potential risks open in ways that other legislation does not. The other bucket, and I highlighted it in my opening remarks as well, speaks to technologies that don't actually collect the individual's identification, but rather seek to guesstimate how old they are. And the providers that provide that kind of technology typically will reference the fact that they can be very effective, but their use cases tend to be amongst younger kids or teenagers on the one hand, and someone who's in their early 20s on the other. So let's say someone who's 15 or 16 on the one hand and someone who's 23, 24 on the other. And, you know, I suppose unsurprisingly in those circumstances, they say that their ability to guesstimate that person's age, or at least ballpark that age as to whether or not they're over or under 18, is quite good. The problem, though, of course, is that that's not the use case with this legislation. This legislation is seeking to identify the difference between someone who is 16 or 17 and someone who is 18, because the 17-year-old gets access, the 18-year-old doesn't. And I think anybody who walks into a high school or takes a look at the incoming class in a university will recognize that it is virtually impossible to distinguish between those who are 17 and those who are 18. And so it is highly error-prone, with some people who have lawful access to this content being excluded and some people who under the law should not have access being able to gain access. And so it's simply a technology that doesn't work very effectively.
One of the concerns that I did want to hear from you on is the whole issue of online privacy. And I'm curious if you could briefly explain what the impact this bill might have on online privacy privacy for Canadians, and whether or not there would be any concerns in respect of the privacy of online users.
You know, thank you for the question on online privacy. And I think we already know that Canadian privacy law is currently in a position where it is out of date and is in the process, we hope, of being updated with Bill C-27, recognizing that it has been really decades since the law was significantly upgraded and meets the kinds of standards that we might expect to see in Canada in the way that we see in some other jurisdictions. So it's already the case that Canadian privacy law, I think in the view of many, is not up to the challenge of dealing with the current kinds of issues that we face right now. If we layer in mandated requirements to collect this kind of information that is potentially matched to websites that involve adult content, or even if it is not, even if it is just the fact that this information is being collected by these foreign services, knowing full well that security breaches, data breaches are very common. They've happened in highly sensitive situations. Think of the Ashley Madison breach from years ago. They've involved highly, very important information. Think of health information. Think of financial information. So this is a regular occurrence. And the idea that there would be any sort of guarantees, both that privacy law could deal with these issues, and even more that once this data gets collected, it would not be subject to a breach, I think runs counter to our lived experience, at least over the past decade, where these vulnerabilities are very real. And so the prospect of creating mandated collection of this information, combining potentially both government information, facial information, normalizing facial recognition, I think presents a whole series of privacy-related risks. We've heard from the privacy commissioners highlighted those as well. And so if there are better ways to do that that are more privacy-friendly, then surely that's the approach we ought to be taking.
The other part I wanted to get to was on page 5, section 9, sub 5A. This is about the effect of the federal court order. And in this section, it says that that court order may have the effect of preventing persons in Canada from being able to access material other than sexually explicit material made available by the organization that has been given notice. So what other material do you think could be prevented from people having access to, and why did you include this section in the bill? Can you clarify this a little bit more for me?
Well, thank you for that question. I'm glad you've given me the opportunity to revisit the issue of website blocking, because I think this is really one of the most problematic aspects of the bill. Essentially, what it's saying is that if there are sites or services, and we could be talking, as I've been saying, about mainstream sites and services from around the world, if they don't comply with Canadian law, if you've got a streaming service that doesn't comply with Canadian law, if you've got a popular search engine or other kind of social media site that says, listen, this is too onerous an obligation, we're simply not going to engage in age verification for all of our Canadian users, it faces the very real prospect of those sites being blocked in Canada. I believe that really does run counter to an open internet, to some of the core principles that we have around net neutrality, with internet providers not inserting themselves in limiting access to lawful sites, to lawful applications. That's a principle that has been upheld by successive governments. It's one that was the subject of a motion that enjoyed all party support in the House of Commons. And it is very difficult to reconcile legislation that, on the one hand, expressly acknowledges it may lead to blocking of lawful content. I mean, there simply isn't any doubt about that. And I think it really would face a serious charter challenge if this actually does become law. But the idea that we would establish in law a positive possibility of blocking access to lawful content is very tough for us to then turn around and say we continue to support the principles of net neutrality, knowing that we've got legislation that envisions blocking lawful access to content that many Canadians will have a lawful right to access. So both the content itself is lawful. The individuals in Canada, many of them have a lawful right to access it. And yet the legislation takes the position that can be ordered blocked by a court. because a foreign site says they are not going to engage in this potentially high risk requirement and costly requirement of age verification.
So by relying on that external definition, were you aware that the majority of online streaming organizations, and like we can think of household names like HBO, Hulu, and Netflix, which are commonly available to families across this country, that you know, they're not accessed for their pornographic content, but they do host content that sometimes does contain sensitive aspects and some aspects of sexually explicit material. Were you aware that they would also be implicated within the wording of the bill as it's currently presented?
I'm looking at the criminal code and trying to understand the argument here. But we have one definition of sexually explicit material in the criminal code. And implicitly, it's sort of being suggested that maybe we could have multiple different definitions of sexually explicit material operating at the same time. But it seems eminently logical that you would have one definition that relies on the existing jurisprudence. And look, if, as Mr. Biddle has suggested, if this definition covers Game of Thrones, then it's already a problem because it's already violates the criminal code if in the commission of another offense you were to show a child that material. So you already could run afoul of the criminal code if you put on Game of Thrones in your home for your 16-year-old. That's not happening. No one's getting arrested and going to jail because they let their 16-year-old watch Game of Thrones. So if that's not happening already offline, then maybe that suggests that this extensive reinterpretation of what the existing law already says is a little bit exaggerated.
I'd like to thank both MPs for the question. This is an issue that's obviously started to attract a considerable amount of attention, and I think that's with good reason. This issue of using a criminal code definition for sexually explicit material, which certainly, Senator Mavil DeShane has argued is a pretty neutral approach. Obviously, Jenis suggests that it's an exaggeration to express some of the concern, saying that, as we just heard, if this is true, that this would result in requiring age verification for someone under 18 accessing a show like Game of Thrones, then surely the same would apply if they were accessing it at home through their cable or satellite system. I think the reality is once you take a look at how the definition appears within the criminal code, it becomes readily apparent that that's in fact not the case, that there is a very real problem with relying on this definition in this way, and it massively expands the scope of this legislation. So I think it's first worth noting that the Bill S-210, as I say, does use the criminal code definition of sexually explicit material that's contained in section 171.1 sub 1 of the criminal code. Now, it's important to understand that that definition on its own doesn't do very much within the criminal code, doesn't really do anything at all within the criminal code. If we continue, it actually speaks to every person commits an offense who transmits, makes available, distributes, or sells sexually explicit material. And then it provides three subheads, an A, B, and a C. It's for the A involves where they do that for persons who are under 18. The B is where it's persons under age 16. And the C is where it's persons who are under age 14. And each of these criminal offenses involve another sexual related crime. So we're talking about things like exposure, or procuring sexual activity, or permitting underage sexual activity, or incest, or child pornography, or trafficking underage persons, and a series of prostitution provisions. In other words, it's not a crime to transmit sexually explicit material on its own. You only potentially run afoul of the criminal code if you do so in the context of one of these other crimes, and that's where this definition becomes important. The problem is that in Bill S-210, it uses exactly that definition, that any organization that for commercial purposes makes available sexually explicit material on the internet to a young person is guilty of an offense. So it's not within the context of any of these other offenses. It stands on its own, which is why in the context of, let's say, an episode like Game of Thrones, if you do this online and it meets the definition, because the definition of what is sexually explicit material includes even something as limited as if the person is female, her breasts, if it's a depiction for a sexual purpose. In other words, a topless model in a sexually suggestive pose qualifies as sexually explicit material under the criminal code. And so if you've got that, if you've got this very broad definition for what kind of content is included here, And you have this very, this immediate application that's saying simply making that available via the internet, that really does loop in wide range of content and by extension then a wide range of services that would be required to engage in this kind of age verification. You don't have that in the context of someone watching the same program through cable or satellite because the criminal code doesn't apply to that. It's applying where you've got one of these other issues involved. And so, as I mentioned in my opening, ironically, for a bill that's designed to create an equivalency between online and offline, this actually does the flip and makes it far more onerous in the online situation where streaming suddenly requires age verification while making the same content available via a cable system does not.
My question is really on 11.2, the wording before we get to the list, because I asked this to the senator. It just says, before prescribing an age verification method under subsection 1, the governor in general must consider whether the method... are you satisfied with language that says must consider, or would you prefer language that forces the governor and council to actually follow these? Like, for me, personally, I look at that. That gives the government a little bit of a way out, like, oh, we addressed 3 out of 5. We did consider everything. But if the governor and council was forced to verify that it is reliable, that it maintains privacy, that it collects and uses personal information solely for age verification purposes, do you have an opinion on that?
Thank you for that question, which I think highlights the weakness of the privacy safeguards within the legislation. And, you know, it's quite clear that the wording does not require the standards that are established within S210 within this technology. So it doesn't say that as the government identifies the age verification technology that will be used, these are the attributes or the features that it must have consistent with the privacy safeguards that most Canadians would expect. Instead, it talks about considering these in its move towards deciding which technologies may be covered and which will not. That standard is a very, very low threshold. You know, it literally takes nothing more than the government having affirmed that it considered some of those factors or all of those factors and then proceeded to make whatever decision it decided to make. And so we see that play out in any number of different contexts. We see it when the CRTC is given a policy direction and it's required to consider what the government states, but it remains independent and can decide what it wants. The same would be true here, of course. I mean, cabinet or government council can always decide what it wants. In this instance, it's merely being asked to consider a series of factors. If we are serious about saying that we want to embed within this legislation strong privacy protections, then it seems to me that those privacy safeguards or protections ought to be non-negotiable. They ought to be clear-cut, clearly articulated, and mandated requirements in order to receive approval. That doesn't mean we're specifying the particular technology, but we are saying that this technology must have these features in order to receive a government approval. Okay, those are some of the questions that were asked. Don't have time to go through all of them, but hopefully this is a useful exercise to get a sense of some of the kinds of questions that MPs had on their minds and some alternative responses that they didn't necessarily get from some of the prior witnesses. There are obviously many, many people that frankly should have been called before committee. These are hearings that should have gone on for many sessions where there was the opportunity or would be the necessity to call in experts on privacy, on the internet, on this technology. And then of course, also on some of the issues in terms of ensuring that children are adequately protected. Frankly, the kind of hearings that one would hope we are going to see around Bill C-63. But to pass this legislation without having conducted those hearings, knowing that there are these problems, there are these very real risks, I think to me would be just enormously irresponsible. And so while it seems likely that the bill will come out of committee unamended, even lead proponents of the bill have always said that it's not perfect. In fact, Senator Neville Deschênes said exactly that when she appeared before committee, suggesting that there is room for the committee to improve it. Doesn't sound like we're going to see any of those improvements. And so then the real question, I suppose, if that is what happens, is once the bill gets back to the full House, whether we get, in addition to the government MPs, at least one other party think the better of this legislation one other party, I think, frankly, come to its senses and realize that while the intent may be good, this particular piece of legislation is not. It should be defeated, and there may well be other ways, perhaps starting with Bill C-63 as a mechanism to try to address some of the very real concerns that sparked this legislation in the first place. That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.